A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I remember the first day of that landscaping job. I got home, collapsed onto the sofa, and genuinely could not move. Didn't want to. My feet were throbbing. My lower back felt like someone had replaced my spine with rebar. I lay there staring at the ceiling, thinking, there is no way I can do this again tomorrow.
Then you did.
Then I did. And here's the thing that still gets me. 2 weeks later, the same work felt almost routine. Still tiring, sure, but not that full-body system crash. The body had just figured it out.
That's the thing Daniel's getting at in his prompt. He sent us this one about his own experience with summer jobs. Landscaping, lifeguarding, working in the family picture framing store, and he zeroes in on that landscaping gig as the one that really broke him physically. The first few days were brutal, but he adapted. And it got him wondering about the guys who do this kind of work, not for a few months, but for years. The road workers he sees day after day here in the Middle East, the guys on construction sites in blazing sun, oil rig hands. How does the body handle that unending physical toll, and is there a point where it just gives out?
It's a question that feels urgent when you look at what's happening right now. You've got millions of migrant workers across the Gulf construction sector, UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, enduring extreme heat and physical demands that push right up against what the human body can actually survive. We talk a lot about automation and the future of work, but right now, today, there are bodies out there doing things that would put most of us on the floor in an hour.
The question underneath Daniel's question is really this. What does it cost, physically, to do that work for a living? Not just the first week, not just the first summer, but year after year. And the answer turns out to be more complicated than you get stronger.
That first day collapse got me thinking. How does the body actually make this transition from agony to routine? And what happens when you keep pushing for years, not weeks?
Let's trace this. The central paradox is that the human body is remarkably plastic. It adapts to physical stress by building muscle, improving cardiovascular efficiency, developing calluses, all of it. But adaptation has limits. And the same mechanisms that enable survival on a construction site also lead to chronic degradation over time.
The thing that fixes you also breaks you.
I think of it as a three-phase model. Phase one is acute shock, those first days or weeks where everything hurts and your body is in full alarm mode. Phase two is physiological accommodation. That's the weeks to months window where real adaptation happens. And then phase three is chronic compensation, years to decades where the body develops workarounds for accumulating damage. That third phase is where things get interesting and also kind of grim.
We're going to start with the science of how the body adapts to manual labor, the actual mechanisms, not just you get used to it. Then we'll look at the long-term toll on workers who do this for decades. And finally, what this means for how we value and protect physical labor.
This episode is really about the body as a tool. How it gets stronger, how it breaks down, and the gap between those two trajectories. And that gap between adaptation and breakdown is where a lot of workers spend their entire careers.
Let's start with the first few weeks, the acute adaptation phase. This is where the body is screaming at you, but also where the most dramatic changes happen.
Here's what's actually going on in those first 2 to 4 weeks. Most people assume you're building muscle, and eventually you are, but the earliest strength gains come from something else entirely, neural adaptation. Your nervous system is learning how to recruit motor units more efficiently.
Break that down.
A motor unit is a single motor neuron and all the muscle fibers it controls. When you first start doing heavy physical work, your brain is clumsy at activating these. It fires too many for small tasks, not enough for big ones, the timing is off. Over the first few weeks, your nervous system gets dramatically better at coordinating which motor units fire, in what sequence, and with how much force. This is why someone can get noticeably stronger in 2 weeks without visible muscle growth. The muscle was always there, the brain just got better at using it.
It's a software update, not a hardware upgrade.
That's a perfect way to put it. The hardware upgrade, actual muscle hypertrophy, takes longer, usually 6 to 8 weeks before it's measurable, but the software update happens fast, and it makes a huge difference in functional capacity. Which explains why that second week of landscaping didn't feel like my muscles were bigger. They weren't. My brain had just figured out how to lift a root ball without fighting itself.
I remember the hunger, though. That was the other thing Daniel mentioned. You learn not to skip breakfast ever. I was eating constantly and still losing weight.
That's real. Manual laborers often require 3,500 to 5,000 plus calories daily, depending on the intensity and the heat. There was a study in the Journal of Occupational Health in 2023 that tracked construction workers in their first month on the job. They found a 40% increase in work capacity, which tracks, but also a 60% increase in cortisol and inflammatory markers.
Even as you're getting stronger, your body is under significant stress. The adaptation is real, but it's not free.
Your body is essentially running a deficit on recovery while it builds capacity. Which brings us to one of the most important and least discussed aspects of this, heat adaptation. Because for the workers Daniel's talking about, the guys on road crews and construction sites in the Gulf, heat isn't just an environmental factor. It's the primary physiological challenge.
This is where adaptation has a hard ceiling, right?
The body's heat acclimatization process is impressive. Over 7 to 14 days of progressive heat exposure, your plasma volume increases, literally more blood to carry heat to the skin. You start sweating earlier at a lower core temperature threshold, and your sweat becomes more dilute because your body gets better at conserving sodium. The result is more effective cooling with less electrolyte loss.
That's the adaptation Daniel was feeling. The body getting smarter about thermoregulation.
Here's the ceiling. There's a concept called wet bulb temperature. That's the temperature measured by a thermometer wrapped in a wet cloth, so it accounts for both heat and humidity. The theoretical human survivability limit for physical labor is a wet bulb temperature of 35 degrees Celsius. That's 95 degrees Fahrenheit at 100% humidity. Above that threshold, the air is so saturated with moisture that sweat cannot evaporate. And if sweat can't evaporate, the body cannot cool itself. No amount of adaptation changes this.
Because it's physics, not biology.
It's physics. And Gulf states regularly approach this threshold during summer months. We're talking about outdoor workers doing heavy physical labor in conditions where the margin between safe and dangerous is razor thin.
That's before we even get to the long-term stuff. Because here's the dark side of adaptation that doesn't get talked about enough. The same mechanisms that help workers cope also mask early warning signs.
This is huge. Micro-tears in muscle tissue accumulate. Tendons develop micro-damage that doesn't trigger pain until it's significant. The body's pain signaling system itself adapts. Workers learn to ignore low-grade pain, which allows injuries to worsen silently.
I remember this from the landscaping job. After a while, the soreness became background noise. You stop noticing it. And that's useful in the short term. You can't work if you're fixated on every ache. But it's also how people end up with injuries they didn't see coming.
The clinical term is habituation to nociceptive signals. Your brain essentially turns down the volume on pain signals that it's receiving constantly. From an evolutionary perspective, this makes sense. If you're in a situation where you have to keep moving despite pain, being paralyzed by it is maladaptive. But from a long-term health perspective, it means damage accumulates below the threshold of conscious awareness.
The body's great trick, I'll just stop telling you about the pain, is also the thing that lets you destroy yourself slowly.
This is where the three-phase model starts to get dark. Phase 1, acute shock, the pain is loud and obvious. Phase 2, accommodation, you're getting stronger and the pain recedes. But phase 3, chronic compensation, is where the body has been muting those signals for so long that by the time something forces its way into conscious awareness, the damage is often substantial.
The body adapts remarkably well in the short term. But what about the long term? What happens when adaptation becomes compensation, and compensation becomes breakdown?
This is where the research gets sobering. After 10 to 20 years of heavy manual labor, the body's compensatory mechanisms begin to fail in predictable patterns. Let's talk about the spine first. Construction workers have 3 times higher rates of herniated lumbar discs compared to office workers. That's not a small difference. That's a tripling of risk for one of the most debilitating injuries a person can experience.
That's not an acute injury from one bad lift. That's cumulative.
almost always cumulative. Each day of heavy lifting, repetitive bending, and awkward postures causes microtrauma to the annulus fibrosus, the outer ring of the disc. Over years, these microtears accumulate until one day, often during a perfectly routine lift, the disc herniates. The worker thinks it happened in that moment, but really it's been building for a decade.
What about joints? I feel like knees would be the obvious one.
Knee osteoarthritis is endemic among retired manual laborers. Studies of retired oil rig workers show a prevalence of over 40%. For context, the general population prevalence for that age group is around 15 to 20%. And it's not just knees. Chronic tendinopathies in shoulders and elbows are extremely common. Rotator cuff damage, lateral epicondylitis, tennis elbow, though ironically it's far more common among construction workers than tennis players.
Daniel mentioned oil rig hands specifically. What's the profile there?
Oil rig work combines several of the worst factors: heavy lifting, repetitive motion, long shifts, often 12 hours or more, and a work environment that's inherently hazardous. The injury patterns tend to involve the lower back, shoulders, and hands. But there's also a less visible toll. Vibration damage from power tools causes something called hand-arm vibration syndrome. It damages blood vessels and nerves in the fingers, leading to numbness, loss of dexterity, and something called vibration white finger, where the digits literally blanch from reduced circulation.
All of this accumulates toward what researchers call occupational disability. Not a single injury, but a cumulative degradation that makes continuing the work impossible by age 50 or 55.
That's the term, and it creates a brutal inflection point. These are workers who have spent decades building physical capacity for one specific type of work. They're strong, they're skilled, they know how to read a load and pace themselves through a 12-hour shift, and then suddenly, they can't do it anymore. The body says no. And because their entire professional identity and skill set is built around physical capability, the transition is devastating.
There's a 2024 study from the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health that found construction workers over 45 have a 70% higher rate of chronic pain conditions than age-matched controls in sedentary jobs.
That's not a marginal difference. That's a structural outcome of the profession. And it connects directly to what Daniel was asking about, the guys on road crews and construction sites in the Middle East. Because those workers face all of these risks, plus the heat, plus a set of structural factors that make everything worse.
Let's talk about the Gulf specifically, because this is where the science of physical adaptation collides with labor policy.
Migrant workers from South Asia and Southeast Asia, Nepal, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, the Philippines, make up the vast majority of the construction workforce in UAE, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia. They're working 10 to 12 hour shifts, often 6 days a week, in temperatures that regularly exceed 40 degrees Celsius. And they're doing it under the kafala sponsorship system, which ties their legal residency to a specific employer.
Explain why that matters for health outcomes.
Because if your employer controls your ability to stay in the country, you have very little leverage to demand safer conditions, to report injuries, or to seek medical care without employer permission. Human Rights Watch documented in 2024 that heat-related illnesses are systematically underreported in the Gulf construction sector. Workers fear that reporting illness or injury will lead to termination and deportation.
You've got the physiological ceiling, the wet bulb temperature limit. And then you've got a structural ceiling where the system disincentivizes workers from acknowledging when they've hit it.
The consequences are measurable. During the run-up to the Qatar World Cup, there were thousands of documented heat stress cases among workers on the infrastructure projects, and those are just the documented ones. The true number is almost certainly much higher because of that under-reporting dynamic.
There's also a psychological dimension here that Daniel's prompt hints at. He talks about wondering how these guys do it. Not just physically showing up, but the mental adaptation to unending physical toll with minimal vacation.
This is where the concept of occupational identity becomes really important. Workers who define themselves through their physical capability, and many manual laborers do, face an existential crisis when their bodies fail. It's not just losing a job, it's losing a sense of self.
That's distinct from the grit narrative that gets celebrated in popular discourse. The idea that if you just push through, if you're tough enough, you'll be fine.
Grit is real, resilience is real, but there are psychological adaptations that can become maladaptive in the same way the physiological ones can. The ability to ignore pain and keep working is useful, until it leads you to ignore the signal that says your rotator cuff is about to tear.
We've got this picture. The body adapts remarkably well in the short term through neural and metabolic changes. It can even handle heat, up to a hard physical limit. But over years and decades, the same adaptive mechanisms that keep workers functional also mask accumulating damage. And for workers in systems like the Gulf's kafala structure, the ability to advocate for recovery is constrained by the threat of deportation.
The numbers bear this out. Occupational injuries cost approximately 4% of global GDP annually, according to the International Labor Organization's 2023 report. That's trillions of dollars in lost productivity, medical costs, and human suffering. And a disproportionate share of that burden falls on workers who have the least ability to absorb it.
Given all this, the remarkable adaptation and the real costs, what can we actually do about it? Let's get practical.
I think we need to think about this in three buckets: for workers themselves, for employers and policymakers, and for the broader public that benefits from this labor.
Start with the workers. If you're someone doing this kind of work, what actually helps?
The single most important concept is periodization, rotating between high-demand and low-demand activities rather than doing the same intense work every day. This is something elite athletes understand intuitively, but it's rarely applied systematically in construction or manual labor. Your body needs variation in load to recover properly.
It's not just about rest. It's about active recovery. Different kinds of movement that don't stress the same tissues.
There's a critical distinction that workers need to learn: the difference between muscle fatigue and joint or tendon pain. Muscle fatigue after heavy work is normal and generally safe. Pain that's sharp, localized to a joint or tendon, or that persists beyond the usual recovery window is a warning signal. The adaptation that mutes pain perception is useful for muscle soreness but dangerous for structural damage.
You mentioned earlier that workers learn to ignore low-grade pain, so you're saying they need to unlearn some of that, or at least be more discerning about which pain to ignore.
And that's hard, because the culture on many job sites equates ignoring pain with toughness. But the data is clear: the workers who have the longest careers are often the ones who are most attentive to their bodies, not the ones who push through everything.
What about employers? What's the case for investing in worker health, beyond just basic decency?
The economic case is overwhelming. Every dollar spent on ergonomic interventions, heat stress prevention, and adequate recovery time returns multiple dollars in reduced injury costs, lower turnover, and higher productivity. The ILO report I mentioned: 4% of global GDP lost to occupational injuries. That's not just a humanitarian problem, that's an enormous economic inefficiency.
For the Gulf states specifically, where the kafala system creates those perverse incentives, what's the fix?
The structural fix is decoupling residency from a single employer, which several Gulf states have begun to reform, though progress is uneven and enforcement remains weak in practice. But there's another piece here that doesn't get enough attention: the knowledge embedded in experienced workers' bodies. A veteran bricklayer who's been doing it 20 years isn't just stronger than a first-year apprentice. He knows things. How to read the weight of a load before he lifts it. How to pace himself through a shift in 40-degree heat. Which movements conserve energy and which ones waste it. That's genuine expertise.
It's expertise that doesn't live in manuals or training videos. It lives in the body.
The ability to sense force distribution, to anticipate how a load will shift, to position yourself before the lift in a way that protects your spine, these are refined over thousands of repetitions. Calling this unskilled labor misses the entire cognitive dimension of physical work.
Daniel's prompt actually gets at this indirectly. He talks about learning proper handling as part of the adaptation, not just getting stronger, but getting smarter about how you move. That learning curve is real, and it's sophisticated.
It's one of the things we lose when we talk about physical labor purely in terms of toll and damage. Yes, the body breaks down, but before it does, it becomes extraordinarily capable. The same roofer who at 55 has chronic shoulder problems was, at 35, doing things with his body that most humans simply cannot do.
The question isn't just, how do we prevent the breakdown? It's also, how do we preserve the capability while minimizing the cost?
Here's the frame I think is most useful. We should think of manual laborers as occupational athletes. They train, they perform, they need recovery, they develop sport-specific skills, and their careers have a performance window that eventually closes. The difference is that we build entire support systems around elite athletes, trainers, nutritionists, periodized training schedules, medical monitoring, and we give almost none of that to the people building our infrastructure.
The roofer at 35 is performing at an elite level in terms of what the human body can do. We just don't call it elite because we've decided some physical performances count and others don't.
The double standard is stark. If an NFL running back has a short career and chronic pain afterward, we treat it as a tragic but understood cost of the profession. If a construction worker has the same trajectory, we treat it as an individual failure or an unavoidable fact of that kind of work. The physiology is the same. The respect we give it is not.
The practical takeaway for the broader audience. The people who aren't doing this work and aren't employing people who do is partly about how we see it. Not romanticizing. Not dismissing. Recognizing that the guy on the road crew has a form of expertise you don't have and that his body is making a calculation every day that yours isn't asked to make.
That calculation has a ledger. Present capability on one side, future cost on the other. Every heavy lift, every shift in extreme heat, every year of accumulated microtrauma, the body records it. The bill comes due eventually. Understanding that doesn't solve the problem, but is the prerequisite for taking it seriously.
We've seen the science, the stories, and the solutions. But there's one question that keeps nagging at me.
What's nagging at you?
As automation and mechanization keep eating away at the need for heavy physical labor in some contexts, what do we lose? Not just jobs, but the knowledge. The stuff embedded in the bodies of experienced workers that doesn't transfer easily to a machine or a manual.
That's the thing that keeps me up, too. A veteran rigger who spent 20 years on oil platforms knows how to read a load before he touches it. He can feel through the soles of his boots whether the deck is vibrating normally or something's off. He knows how to pace himself through a 12-hour shift in 45-degree heat, not from a training video, but from thousands of days of doing it.
That knowledge just vanishes when the body gives out. It doesn't get written down. It doesn't get uploaded to some algorithm.
There's a whole field of research on this, tacit knowledge, embodied expertise. The philosopher Michael Polanyi wrote about it. The idea that we know more than we can say. A bricklayer's hands know things his mouth can't articulate. And that's not a failure of articulation. It's that some knowledge only exists in the doing.
When we talk about automating construction or mechanizing the heavy lifting, we're not just replacing muscle. We're discarding a form of intelligence that doesn't happen to live in language.
We're doing it without really accounting for the loss. We measure productivity gains from mechanization. We don't measure the loss of embodied knowledge that took decades to accumulate.
Which brings me back to Daniel's question. How do those guys do it? I think part of the answer is that they know things we don't. Not just in the sense of being tougher or more resilient, but in the sense of having developed a genuine expertise that the rest of us never need to develop.
The body's ability to adapt to physical labor is remarkable. We've traced the whole arc, the neural rewiring in those first brutal weeks, the metabolic shifts, the heat acclimatization, the slow accumulation of proprioceptive skill. But it's not infinite. Every worker on a road crew or a construction site or an oil platform is making a calculation every day, trading present capability for future cost.
Understanding that trade-off is the first step toward honoring the work properly. Not romanticizing it, not pitying it, just seeing it clearly for what it is.
The workers who build our cities and infrastructure are performing at a level that deserves the same serious attention we give to any other domain of elite human performance. The fact that we've mostly failed to give it doesn't mean we can't start.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, Byzantine court ceremonial required that anyone approaching the emperor perform proskinesis, full prostration, 3 times while advancing, but one visiting diplomat reportedly attempted to substitute a series of increasingly deep bows instead, triggering a 3-day procedural crisis over whether the audience could legally proceed.
A 3-day procedural crisis over bow depth.
That's the most Byzantine thing I've ever heard.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop.
If you want to send us a question like Daniel did, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. We'll be here when you get back.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.